Kim, and welcome to EsoTorque's podcast, You Can't Eat the Sunshine, for the week of November 3rd, 2014. Join us this week as we visit with Scott Rubel to get the story of his Uncle Michael's Rubel Castle, a breathtaking folk art environment in Glendora. We'll also visit with Mitchell Crawford, who recalls his family's San Gabriel Valley retail empire, including the legendary Crawford's Market at Five Points in El Monte. So stay tuned.
Los Angeles.
El Pueblo. Lotus Land. The City of Angels.
The Day of the Locust. The slide area, where all the fruits and nuts ended up when they turned the country on its ear.
But you and I were born here. Don't mind a few oddballs in the mix.
They add flavor. Growing up in Cheviot Hills, my compass pointed straight to 5th and Main.
As a kid in Hollywood, I was forbidden to take the bus to the Central Library. But I did it anyway.
Because you've got to start at the center to understand this confounding and fantastic city.
Which makes nonsense of history and breaks all the rules.
Rainer Banham said that.
He taught us well.
In the 1980s at UC Santa Cruz, now on our tours and in our time travel blogs, we're continuing the conversation.
Raymond Chandler's Los Angeles and Charles Bukowski's The Birth of Noir. Route 66, the lowdown on downtown. The real Black Dahlia.
Positive public space, endangered landmarks, forgotten lore,
memory maps, mysteries, murder,
the allocation of resources,
the hidden forces that shape public policy,
Skid Row,
Bunker Hill,
preservation,
restoration,
redevelopment.
It's a four-letter word.
Los Angeles. You can't eat the sunshine, but you can drive around and take a long, hard look.
And listen to the stories.
And pass them on. Why are we doing this again?
Because we love the place with a passion that goes beyond sense or reason.
So did Rainer Banham.
So we did. Now let's begin.
You can't eat the sunshine, but you can make a beeline for the best of the coastline. La 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 la. Skid Row, Solano Canyon, the Doria, and Pico Union, the long-lost neighborhood called Herman between South Pass and Highland Park, Grand Central Park. It is divine. Sunshine, but it's a gold mine of fabulous oddities like Brugier's Dairy, Angela Savvy, Bob's Big Boy, in Downey Forest Lawn Cemetery. You can't eat the sunshine, but make a beeline for la la la. You can't eat the sunshine.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for listening to our podcast for the week of November 3rd, 2014. It is called You Can't Eat the Sunshine, and it is something I ruminate on a daily basis. I'm so excited about this week. This week is Visionaries in San Gabriel Valley. Visionaries in San Gabriel Valley. We have Mitchell Crawford. He is the grandson of the couple who started Crawford's Mark Grocery Empire, Crawford's Corner, Valley and New, the Crawford's Market at Five Points in El Monte. There's still an extant Crawford's Market at in Glendale. It's now a Ralph's Fresh Fair. It's at Stoker and Central, and we were just there. Had some really great, that fermented Persian flatbread across the street. So this is the first of several podcasts interviews with Mitchell. I'm hoping for interview number two with him. He'll talk about the Man from Mars bandit uniform being displayed at the Crawford's Market in El Monte's Five Points. I'm hoping we can get into that. So that's Mitchell. He's pure pleasure. He's just so, it's great. We're also going to interview Scott Rubel. Scott Rubel is the nephew of Michael Rubel. Michael Rubel created Rubel Farm, more commonly known as Rubel Castle. We use the term farm because it is a compound, and the castle, which he built around the structure, the skeleton of a out of commission water tank. The castle is just one of many important and interesting features on the farm. This is a distinctly two-part interview with Scott where we just focus on backstory. for just doing the backstory of all the people that helped Michael get to where he needed to be. So he was just mixing cement, pouring concrete, and laying river rock every day of his life for about 20, 25 years. And it resulted in a really, really beautiful compound, which I think is one of the most important folk art environments on the Pacific Coast, in my opinion. It's truly extraordinary. And the breadth and scope of the people involved. We're not even going to talk about the castle this time. We're just... So that was a very long introduction. I sort of like to keep things, you know, he's going to talk for 30 seconds now, and then Kim's going to talk about the Pishka. Well, so I talked for a bit. I did a nice setup, and now Kim, Pishka Maven.
I can do that. Hey, you know, if you like the show, and we hope you do, and you're inclined to support us and contribute, you can go to the link on the podcast page and make a donation of any size, large or small, singular or recurring. Yeah, recurring, you'd have to do it yourself, of course. I haven't coded that, but maybe at some point I will. In any case, we are so appreciative of the supporters of this podcast. It means a lot to us that when you listen, you think, hey, I'm going to throw a little something in the Pishka pot to help them with gas and tacos and what have you while we're out around Southern California looking for interesting people to talk to, for you to listen to. And as you'll notice in today's podcast interview, we were hanging out down at Rhodey's when we interviewed Mitchell, so, you know, there's some omelets involved. Your support is never obligatory. Always appreciated. Thanks.
Okay, Kim, let's get into closely watched terrain. So finish that sip of tea, because I'm going to ask you what you think about what's happened to the former Ruskin Art Club.
I don't like it. The Ruskin Art Club, you know, this was a place that was... Spanish Colonial Revival house down in the Mid-Wilshire district, very much on our radar as a place we wanted to go to an event of, but it was always kind of hard to figure out when the events were happening, and a lot of times they coincided with things
we always were Saturdays at 11 a.m.
Right, so we never made it down there, but it was great to know that there was this, you know,
almost century old
creative club named after John Ruskin, your hero, Richard.
Not your hero.
You know, for some reason, you think I was studying Ruskin at UC Santa Cruz.
You were studying Morris.
I wasn't studying Morris. I was studying Sir John Soane, which couldn't be more different. But for some reason, you're convinced that I was a Pre-Raphaelite. And I do love you for believing this. That was a different me. In any case, apparently the Ruskin Art Club still exists. If you look at their Facebook page, there's an announcement from March where it says, hey, sorry, we're selling our building because we don't know how to keep it up, but we're going to take the money we make from selling our building and keep doing what we do, which is supporting the arts in Southern California. And that was the last post. So the building was sold for over $1 million. As far as I can tell, there was no attempt to, like, you know, have events there and raise money and do whatever maintenance needed to be done. I'm not at all clear that there was any sort of, like, drop-dead emergency regarding the building. I think it was a 1920s building that probably had been, you know, used hard for many years and probably needed to be spruced up if it was going to be sold. I don't think it was falling down around its ears. But in any case, it was sold, and it's being flipped. It's been doubled in price, and it's now a historic cultural monument, so it can't be changed much. But it's on the market as a private home, and it's sad. It's sad to me that it won't continue to be a clubhouse for people who care about the arts, and I don't really understand what the Ruskin's going to be in the future. Its mailing address appears to be Judson Art Glass, though, so I guess maybe we can find out.
We will. So, Kim, let's play a game. I'm going to say a word, and you're gonna respond. Okay. C-R-A.
This is a family podcast.
C-R-A.
I don't know what you're aiming at, sweetheart.
C-I-M.
Oh, Sim Group? Yeah, I don't like them. Sim Group is this giant developer that for some reason is got, like, most favored developer status in Southern California, or in Los Angeles specifically. They're just, like, the monsters.
Okay, hold on. We're not done. We're still playing word association game.
Okay. I thought we were still talking about the Ruskin Art Club. No. What do you think of the Ruskin Art Club? Everyone wants to know what you think.
I think it's terrible. We're playing the game, though.
Okay, but before we move away from Ruskin, there is such a paucity of public space where people can get together and talk about culture without being forced to listen to crappy music, watch a video screen, or buy expensive food and drinks. So the loss of a place like this, you know, the literally millions of hours of pleasure and learning and good fellowship within those walls has ended. And I think that's worth mourning. It's not cool. You know, Curbed is like, hey, check out this great place you can buy. And I'm like, hey, this sucks.
Can we go back to the word game? Mm-hmm. Okay. We did CRA. We did CIM. Let's try one more.
Am I supposed to say, like, one word? Is this a psychological experiment? I think I'm doing very poorly at it.
You're going to get better. Okay. Spaghetti.
Mizrutha cheese! Yeah, okay. You want to talk about Sunset and Gordon, which was, oh, it was a wonderful old radio studio. What was it, K&X?
Yeah.
K&X. It was an auto showroom in the 30s. Sunset and Gordon is also pretty much where my great-grandfather Louis's tire yard was when he first came to Los Angeles from Egypt. So, you know, I have a real emotional attachment to Sunset and Gordon. And then for many years, it was, you know, we actually had an old spaghetti factory in Hollywood, and it was filled with funky Victorian antiques, and you could eat in an elevated train car. And honestly, the food was...
It was pretty bad.
Yeah, I'm not going to say it was pretty bad. I mean, it was not haute cuisine, but at the same time, you know, for like $10, you could get a bunch of people together and everyone could have a nice filling meal, and it was fun. And then, you know, the property sold a couple of times, and because this was a historic structure, they closed down the spaghetti factory, and then, you know, it was like one of those, hey, wouldn't it be great if someone torched this place kind of situations, where it just sat there, it was getting tagged, no one was taking care of it, it looked like hell. But, you know, historic cultural resources said, you're going to have to maintain this facade as part of the new development. Giant tower, because that's all they want in Hollywood, whether there are, you know, subterranean vaults ready to swallow these towers up, whether the streets and freeways can handle it or not, who cares? So, what does Sim Group do? They tear the whole thing down in the middle of the night. And when called on it, they say, oh, the facade was in such terrible condition, there was no way to integrate it into the design, even though we got, you know, millions of dollars in concessions for doing so. They were sued, Richard.
Yeah.
And what happened then?
Yeah, so there's been a ruling issued, and the judge has said that their building permits weren't valid. And that's pretty interesting that a judge has said you basically built this building illegally and no one knows what to do.
Right. People are living there. Not a lot, but a few. And they may have to be, you know, sent elsewhere. But it's not like Sim doesn't have a million buildings in town. In fact, why don't we just give them Los Angeles? No, it's really important because This scofflaw attitude towards historic preservation is endemic in Southern California because all they get is a slap on the wrist. The worst thing that can happen if you actually knock down a historic cultural monument, they can give you a 5-year scorched earth ruling.
They can.
Might. It hardly ever happens. Developers know it doesn't matter. They budget this into their plan. Oh, we'll knock it down. Maybe someone will notice. Maybe they won't. If they are made to really pay through the nose for doing this and taking something beautiful and culturally relevant away from the community and stealing money out of everyone's pockets because they got financial concessions for keeping the historic structure as part of this development, if they're made to pay an appropriate amount, maybe it will stop the next Sim Group or whoever, I mean, stop Sim Group from doing this again. And that would be a really good thing. You know, it needs to be more than a slap on the wrist because once a almost 100-year-old building is gone, that's it. That stretch of Hollywood looks like hell forever.
Okay, Kim, I'm gonna take us gonna raise the bar here a bit. We're gonna take this theme. We're gonna ratchet it up. So have a sip of tea. Okay. So last week you sent me an article from the Los Angeles Review of Books. The article was by Sarah Jane Stratford. Title of the article is Home and History and the Fiction of Los Angeles. This immediately caught my eye because it, of course, was an article. The beginnings of the article was about my old neighbor, Ray Bradbury. Lived in the same neighborhood. I, growing up, would often see Bradbury walking around. Wonderful, wonderful pre-war. Cheviot Hills is just this great little community. Articles about, starts with, what we're going to talk about is a side effect of the article. So I don't want to get too deep in the article because it's a very interesting article about fiction and place building and science fiction and alienation and all these interesting points. So you get to the end of towards the end of the article. Okay, this is the side effect I'm interested in. I'm just going to read the quote. Okay, so this is towards the end of the article, and I'm just going to start reading from the article, Home and History and the Fiction of Los Angeles by Sarah Jane Stratford. One of the difficulties in talking about preservation, this article is about ostensibly the growing threat of mansionization. Do we call it McMansionization? Mansionization, yeah. This article is about the growing threat of mansionization. Ray Bradbury's house is up for sale. So the notion that a developer could purchase the house, tear it down, and then put up something really out of scope with this very charming neighborhood, that's one of the sub-themes of this article. So, again, quoting, one of the difficulties in talking about preservation is that dichotomous thinking continually forces itself into the equation. When I, Sarah the author, when I spoke to Adrian Fine of the Los Angeles Conservancy, he noted that they are getting away from the term preservationist because it has become so loaded, making broad and even civil discourse almost impossible. A bid for preservation is too often greeted with a cry of class warfare, of being an attempt of the upper-class bourgeoisie at maintaining a status quo that suits them. An irony when discussing mansionization, as by its nature is tailored for the wealthiest among us. New paragraph. The Conservancy stresses, however, that it is not against change. Rather, it is attempting to help the city manage change. God bless them. It is attempting to help the city manage change and allow for growth in a way that preserves communal integrity, if not in each and every building in any given area. The Conservancy's primary goal is, in effect, storytelling. Let me repeat that. I'm still in the middle of the paragraph. The Conservancy's primary goal is, in effect, storytelling. What they have observed is that teaching local residents about their area's histories, its origins, past residents, architects, and actions prompts them to become more invested in their homes and the larger communities around them. Citizens are then more inclined to record that history along the streets, letting each house tell its story, even as the surrounding city moves forward into a future and a genre yet unknown.
I don't know. If I subscribe to the Conservancy, you know, if I sent them a check every year, I wouldn't really want to be sending them a check for storytelling. You know, if I want to get HBO, I can get HBO. I thought we were giving money to the Conservancy so they would, you know, lobby for historic preservation. I thought that their job was writing landmarking applications, fighting in court for buildings that are endangered. Storytelling? And how does educating neighbors about their history in their neighborhoods protect against Sim Group or big developers coming in and buying teardowns? This is insane. What is going on?
Oh, I'm sorry, Kim. I think you your cat accidentally deleted that email I sent you last year. I sent you an email last year, and the email said that everything you know about the world is over. So all the notions of public space, they're gone. All the notions about preservation, they're gone. Architecture isn't architecture anymore. It's environmental design for corporate branding. Public space doesn't exist anymore, and it's actually been privatized by corporations who will pay for it. And again, as a side of, as impacts in a positive way their corporate branding. And also, just, you know, you've got to get on board here and be a team player, because it's just folly to think you can preserve old Los Angeles, because no one wants that.
I've said it before, and I'm going to say it again. the Los Angeles Conservancy has lost its rudder. You have things happening like at a tiny little preservation group. Our friends who are behind this cause to save the SMB Streamline Modern at what is supposed to be the gateway to West Hollywood. Two women in the community do all this work on their own time, on their own dime, no financial support from anyone. And then the Conservancy says, wow, this is amazing what you women have discovered and what you've done. And they sue the city of West Hollywood to stop the demolition of this important Wordman and Beckett Streamline Modern building that was on nobody's radar, certainly not the Conservancy's. And yet, at the same time, they're saying we're not preservationists anymore. Why isn't the Conservancy, with its $300,000 buffer in its accounts? We looked at their 990s. That's hundreds of thousands of dollars sitting there. Why aren't you paying people like Kate and Chrissy to do this work if you're not going to do it yourselves? Why aren't you submitting multiple landmarking applications for endangered structures? Why are you running around telling stories when you should be saving buildings?
Tim, see, we're still back to this email that your cat deleted it while you weren't looking that I sent you last year.
No, we're not playing this game that somehow I'm wrong.
You're not wrong, Kim. You're absolutely right. What you fail to understand is that no one cares about what we care about anymore. Preservation has become a side effect of fundraising for very rich people in private residences built before World War II.
Right, which is why the ModCom group, this independent group within the Conservancy of a lot of really passionate, right-on community members who cared about stuff that the Conservancy didn't care about 15, 20 years ago, like signage, you know, they lost their autonomy and basically don't exist anymore as a private little group within the Conservancy. And now, you know, it's all about the big fundraising and the fancy mid-century modern houses because this stuff has gotten hip. We're going to have to find some little niche that no one cares about. Oh, I know. The Mission Revival.
So, you know, this is just what happens when you're in the world, Kim, is everything changes and you just have to steer your course. And I think that the Los Angeles Conservancy is truly lost, and it's very sad. They are an entity that many people look to for direction on this front, and I think people would be shocked to hear about these definition changes, these paradigm shifts, which are so obvious if you just look up at society. But they're happening, and we need to call them out.
Right, and the other important thing to remember about the Conservancy is they have an archive. They've gathered a bunch of books and material, and it's completely inaccessible. How many times have you asked to be able to come in, right off Pershing Square and consult because you're writing landmarking applications? You're a private citizen who's trying to further what is supposed to be their cause, and you would think that there would be some support for members of the community. Certainly, when they see an opportunity to piggyback on what community members are doing, they'll do so. If anyone from the Conservancy is listening, including supporters, including people who work there, guys, come on, get it together. You're really not doing the best that you possibly could do with the resources that you have and with all the goodwill that you've gathered from the community. You are one of the largest preservation organizations in the country. That's what you are. Be what you are. Be what you're supposed to be. People have given you a lot of energy, a lot of money, and a lot of support to do nothing else.
I'm going to subscribe to the I'm going to create an RSS feed to track the page that displays the Conservancy's mission statement, because I suspect it's going to change very quietly over the next 6 months to a year, and I'll get an RSS feed so I can keep track of that. So, Kim, we have to move on because we have to move on, not only emotionally, but because we have to wrap up the introduction. There are, at the moment, no upcoming special events. The Lava Salon is on hiatus. We're going to bring it back in the new year. We're working on a new venue, Cafe Figaro, La Noce de Figaro, commonly known as Cafe Figaro, on Broadway, closed very suddenly about 5 weeks ago. Yeah, I've got an email, Jonathan. Unclear if they're going to reopen. So I am moving on. And we're gonna hit the ground in January. We're gonna relaunch the Lava Salons at the end of January 2015, and I'm using this time well, I think, catching up on just the incessant drumbeat of the salons, taking advantage of that stopping for a second and retooling, refactoring as a good software engineer. And so we have nothing to report upcoming, so that's okay.
I think there's going to be a crime lab on the calendar very, very shortly. Keep an eye on the Lava calendar. It's always worth having a look. And, of course, we're not the only people hosting Lava events, so you'll see some other cultural happenings. And, of course, if anyone's listening who puts on cool events in L.A., readings, theater productions, poetry, what have you, check out the Lava calendar. You might be a good candidate to become a Lava visionary and add things to the Lava list, and we'll send that out to the many people who subscribe.
Okay, good. All right. So Kim, I want to get to the interviews. I'm going to keep this short because Mitchell really speaks for himself. First things first, we are including as a URL in the hyperlink section of the podcast page a link to a Blogspot blog, which Mitchell has absolutely no association with. But I include it because they're fantastic photos, and the better half of the interview is a discussion of the Five Points El Monte store, and this blog has a lot of good photos.
Oh yeah, it's a community website. A lot, you know, one person organized it, but a lot of people have submitted their family photos and their memories. And I just want to make an observation: anyone who has read James Ellroy's book My Dark Places, his memoir, or heard him talk about El Monte, which he talks about so dismissively, keep that in your mind as you listen to the description of this incredible mall. It really was a mall on a single plot of land run by a single family who just brought in all of these entrepreneurs. El Monte was on fire with creativity, and I'm sorry, well, you know, James wasn't there very long before his mom got murdered. I guess they didn't shop at Crawford's.
As always, James leaves me speechless, as always, and I've come to accept that as a good thing. So we're going to interview Mitchell second. So there we go. That website we're going to post, he has no affiliation with.
Richard, it's a fan site about his family's market. It's not like anything controversial. Calm down.
I know. That's all I want to say. Okay. Our first interview is going to be with Scott Rebell. Scott is the nephew of Michael Rebell. Rebell's castle in Glendora is this incredible structure. We're not even going to talk about the compound, really. We're going to talk about important people who shaped Michael's psychic structure, who helped him at important milestones in his life to get to the point where he was just pouring concrete almost every day for 20, 25 years, building this castle. Because we talk about the castle so little, and we just do the backstory, I will quickly give people a sense of what we're talking about. The compound, the farm, we won't get into the different buildings on the farm. We'll just stick with the castle. So basically, Michael purchased a piece of property that had a 25, 30-foot cistern on it. It was empty. It was built for irrigating citrus groves. And for many years, he looked at this giant cistern that was as wide across as it was tall, taller than it was across wide, and thought, if only I could get inside, I could build. And so he had a friend who was in the Navy who was good at ordnance, who could secured ordnance, and they blasted a hole in the base of this giant, the cistern is basically a giant concrete cylinder, right? And they blasted a hole in it and preserved its structural integrity. And once they blasted the hole in it, then really that opened up a whole world of possibility. And so the drawbridge and the river and the moat and just everything started to come into place, and the clock towers. And so that's where I want to leave everyone as we go into our interview with Scott. Scott, I'm here with you. We're at Rubel Farm in Glendora, California. I need for you, first of all, one, introduce yourself and tell us why you're qualified to do this interview with us about this place, and two, tell us about a little bit about this place, because it's so interesting and complicated. We're going to do just this interview on the backstory to this place. So go.
I'm Scott Rubel, and I grew up here, and I actually helped build the castle. We mixed concrete and hauled rocks all through my teenage years and my 20s, and I lived with my uncle on and off for all those years. Rubel Castle was built on an old citrus warehouse that was built by Arthur Bourne, who was an heir to the Singer sewing machine fortune. And he had the money to play around and breed new kinds of oranges and make things happen around here. He wasn't a common farmer, so he was what you would know today as a gentry farmer. And my uncle got the property in 1959 because Mr. Bourne gave the property to the Episcopal Church. And the church tried to develop it for about 10 years and could never figure out how to profit from it. And so the property was eventually bought really cheap by my uncle and his mother when he was 19 years old, and he started living here in the old warehouse.
Okay, we have to stop because we've got to... No, there's nothing to be sorry about. There's no mistakes, but we're just... I need you to... we're standing in front of a castle built of river rock, and there's a drawbridge. Okay, so I don't see any citrus warehouses. I see what looks like a 15th century medieval castle made out of river rock. Yeah. So I'm a little confused, so I need you... In about 2 minutes to tell us why there's a castle built out of river rock in the middle of Glendora. And then we're going to take our time and we're going to tell this wonderful backstory about your uncle, who at 19 had a vision. Okay, so what's this drawbridge?
Am I starting over?
Okay. No, you're just
okay. All right. Well, my uncle Michael lived here for about 10 years before he ever had an idea to build a castle. And he actually used this place as his base for traveling the world. He went through Asia and Europe and basically hitchhiked everywhere. And one day he got back and he said, "The whole world's crowded and the only way to go is up, so I'm going to build towers." And he started mixing concrete one day in 1968. And the first structure he built was the tiny structure inside the old reservoir, which used to be the irrigation pool for the local orange groves. And it was a tiny place, and he built it so he'd have a place to sleep where he could get away from his mother's parties. His mother was living here at the time. And
we'll get to that.
Okay, yeah. And he just kept building from then on and kept going up. He built big foundations and started mixing concrete and hauling rocks from wherever he could get them and local recycling materials. He'd go to junkyards and people would come and bring things to him, and everything went into the walls.
Okay, so we are now... So what you've just described then is a fantastic folk art environment in Glendora, and I'm so happy to be here talking about this. Okay. We agreed, because the story of the construction is so exhaustive and interesting, the question would just keep coming up, why? Why and who and why? Yeah. So we're going to address all these questions before they even come up by the backstory. Okay, we've agreed on a short list of influential people that helped your Uncle Michael realize his vision of this tremendous folk art environment. So I'm just going to pick a name out of the list. We agreed to start with Harry. Tell us who Harry was and what Harry did to help realize this vision of your uncle's.
Well, Harry Duell was my great-grandfather, Michael's grandfather. And when Michael was born, Harry basically said, "Well, the other kids are getting an education. Let's have fun with this one." And and they lived down on Leodora Avenue, which was right next to a city dump. And by the time Michael was 5 years old, he was playing in the dump and starting to build things out of materials that the city would put there. And by the time he was 10 or 11 years old, he was building towers that were 40 feet high with drawbridges all out of palm leaves and tin and wood. And the city would come and tear them down, and he'd build another one. And Harry came to live here after his wife died in the early 60s. And they were living in the old warehouse together. It was a three-generation family. Michael lived here, his mother came to live here, and his mother's father came to live here. And Michael had a real hard time dealing with the city at the time. The city was pressuring him, and they wanted the property to be developed into tract houses, and Michael wanted to do his farm stuff. And Harry started just giving a little back to the city. He'd go out and he'd knock on people's doors, and these were the people who were saying what an eyesore this place was, and he'd go and point out the brown spot on their lawn and say, "Hey, I noticed the paint's peeling from your awnings." And one day the building inspectors came up, and they'd come up in a big black car, and Harry was out there, and he just started telling them stories. And he was 90 years old, but he wasn't senile at all. But he could tell them the same story over and over again, like three times in a row. And they'd be idling the car, and they'd put it in reverse, and he'd just hook his cane around the wind wing and say, "You don't want to pull an old man over, do you?" And pretty soon the city started to fear coming up here. They just didn't want to get caught by Harry in these endless loops of stories that would go on for hours. And pretty soon Michael was being left alone an awful lot. And he mixed a lot of concrete and started basically doing what he wanted to do, because the city just didn't want to be here. It was so unpleasant for them. And I have to give credit to the city too. There were many people who worked within the city who liked what was happening. They saw the spark.
Right. And we'll give credit in the second interview, where we actually get into the creation of this amazing folk art environment. We will give credit where credit is due to the bureaucrats that deserve it, which is a rare experience on this podcast, I gotta tell you. Harry has daughter, Michael's mother. Maybe you should tell us a little about Michael's mom.
Right. Well, Michael's mother, my grandmother Dorothy, along with her sister, went into show business in the late teens, and they became very popular. They worked for Greenwich Village Follies, and were also courted by Ziegfeld, but they never went to work for him. They auditioned for him. And their show business careers basically ended in 1928 when they both got married. And my grandmother Dorothy married Hines, who was an Episcopal priest and also a radio entertainer. And he was a gag writer for someone who was very famous at the time. It was Joe Penner, who was a comedian on the radio. And the whole reason they came out to California in 1934 was because Joe Penner got a contract with Paramount Pictures and started making movies, and my grandfather came out here to write for him. And so some of his early movies have my grandfather's music in them and songs and things like that. So my grandfather became the minister of the local Episcopal church on Vista Bonita, and this is where my family grew up. He built a house in 1939 on Leodora Avenue, and that's where the junkyard was that Michael learned to build castles in all his life. And he himself said that, you know, it doesn't take much to pick up rocks and pile them up. And that's what all he wanted to do all his life. And Dorothy, because of her involvement in the Episcopal Church, was able to help Michael buy this property from the Episcopal Church, because it had been donated to them by Mr. Bourne.
Perfect. And I think it would be, because it's the parties, Michael.
Yeah.
We need to keep moving, but I don't want to forget the parties. So let's put the parties on the table. This will come back in the subsequent interview.
That's what I thought. Yeah. Well, my grandmother's favorite hobby was having parties. She was always a socialite, and the Tin Palace here is over 100 feet long, and it was paradise for her. She was able to decorate it. Every month, that place looked different. She would it was like Christmas every month. You know, she'd put, for Christmas, she'd have Christmas decorations, but for Halloween, it would always be dressed up like Halloween and St. Patrick's Day. And she would have giant parties every month, you know, especially during the early 60s. And there'd be a minimum of 100 people here, sometimes 400, and an orchestra, and sometimes outside barbecues, and sometimes it would all be indoors, but they drove my uncle crazy eventually, and that was one of his inspirations in 1968 to build the bottle house. He just needed to get away from all the noise of his mother, because I read something that somebody else wrote when my uncle was being interviewed, where he said, "I don't understand these people. My God, they never sleep, and all they do is drink."
Good. Okay. I think we've dealt with the parties. Good. Okay. Let's start to work down this list some more. I'm just going to throw some names out. Stanley Baird. Excuse me.
Yes. Stanley Baird was one of the old timers, and my uncle had many surrogate fathers in his life. His dad died when he was basically 5 or 6 years old, and so he kind of adopted all the old timers around here, and he grew up with them and he loved them all. And Stanley Baird was one of the people who always supported Michael through his childhood. And excuse me, sorry about that. And he probably partially financially supported Michael too. I don't know that for sure, but Michael always had time for Stanley. During the 70s, I remember Wednesday night was always Stan Baird night, and Stanley could come over and do whatever they wanted. If he wanted to go out to dinner, they went out to dinner. If he just wanted to sit and drink in Michael's bedroom, that's what they would do. And he always had a place of honor. He'd always get the most comfortable chair. And all I can remember of him as a kid was, you know, basically what he looked like, and that he was a very kind person who always watched over Michael.
Perfect. Okay. Lauren Ward.
Lauren Ward is another one of the old Glendora old-timers, and what I've heard about him is that he actually worked with Mr. Bourne, who owned this property before, and he was also into hybriding oranges and citrus fruits, and I think he had something to do with bringing kumquats to California. And Lauren Ward earned some of his fortune from developing McDonald's. I don't know how he was involved, but apparently his money was from McDonald's restaurants. And when Michael was finishing the castle in 1986, it was some of Lauren Ward's money that helped him buy the stuff he needed to finish the clock tower. Wow. And when Michael was looking for the clock parts and the bells, Lauren Ward said, "Well, I've never done anything to help you," which wasn't true, but he's financially. And what Lauren said, "You know, let me buy you the things you need to finish it."
Okay. And a patron, good,
yeah.
Good. Skipper Landau?
Skipper Landon, his real name is Frank, but Skipper is how we all knew him. And he was a childhood friend of Michael's. They grew up together, and Skipper was one of the geniuses who helped Michael. They actually built a lot of the forts together in that junkyard. And when Michael started developing the property here, Skipper was one of those real technological whizzes. Back before you could go to a store and buy an electric eye or an alarm system, Skipper could make these things work. You know, we had a system of dial telephones around here where we could dial 3 digits on a telephone and open any gate or turn on any light. And Skipper made all this work in the early 60s. It was really amazing. And he had a lot to do with helping this place develop.
Let's just keep going through this list. How about Dorothy? You have some opinion. I know, we're going to work backwards. You have some opinion about Dorothy, I imagine.
You mean my grandmother?
Yes, your grandmother.
Hold on a minute. Well, my grandmother had the misfortune of losing her husband at a very early age. You know, her husband died at the age of 48, and she was basically destitute pretty quick after that and got into real estate. And she was part of the real estate boom in Glendora when the tract houses began being built in the 50s. And her coming to live here was partly an act of generosity. She was helping my dad get through college, and she let him rent her house down on Leodora, and she came to live here. And she really was a force. You know, she was gracious to everyone. She never had a bad word. She was like Will Rogers in that way. She never said anything bad about anybody. And invited absolutely everyone to these parties, including some of the old celebrities that she knew from her connections in the show business days. And they would come up here. I don't know if you know about the Carousel Theater down in Covina. It was one of the most popular theaters you could go to that was outside of Los Angeles back in the 60s. And wow. People like Jack Benny and famous stars would go and perform there. And it was always a treat for them that they would be brought up here to visit Dorothy at the Tin Palace. So, you know, we've had some very, very big celebrities coming to parties here or just visiting, you know, just to get a tour. And that was way before the castle was even built.
Okay. Perfect. Odo and Maria Stade.
Yeah. Odo and Maria Stade lived in a piece of property right behind our house on Leodora Avenue, and I didn't appreciate them as much as I should have when I was a kid, but he was kind of like a second grandfather to me and to Michael. Odo had an incredible history. He started out being a stowaway and coming to Mexico and getting off the ship and being hijacked by Pancho Villa. And he ended up working for Pancho Villa. And he knew so many languages that he was really useful to him. He ended up being an emissary between Pancho Villa and Woodrow Wilson. He got $18 million of Pancho Villa's gold out of Mexico and into banks in France. And he worked for him for many years and also developed Pancho Villa's Air Force, you know, those old bi-wing planes. And the history just keeps going after that. When he left Pancho Villa, he actually got shot, and he came to recuperate in the Sierra Madre Mountains. And he worked for Mr. Vroman, who started Vroman's Bookstore in Pasadena. And from there, he started his own bookstore, which was Hollywood Bookstore, and did pretty well at that, even a little bit through the Depression. But then he ended up joining the Forest Service, and he worked in Glendora, and he apparently helped the government place, he knew the Sierra Madre Mountains so well that he helped the government place the Nike missile sites and, you know, locate all those things. And when I was a kid, you know, he was this kind old man who lived in the back, you know, behind our house, and I visited them every day. And Maria started out in the Greenwich Village Follies too as a seamstress, and that's so she had met my grandmother in the early days in the 20s, so they sort of knew each other. And Maria kept being a seamstress all through. She was still working in her 80s, you know, part-time, but she had her own gifts with literature, and she had a book club that was going all the time. I would go there sometimes every week, and I ended up getting a bunch of her books. And this part probably isn't interesting, but
no. This. I need you to tell us one story about how Odo helped your uncle. Like one moment when it was just like, oh, I don't want to do this, and Odo was like, no. Fortitude, perseverance, yeah. Go.
I think that my uncle based part of his life or what he wanted to do in life on Odo's adventures, because Odo had so many stories. He was a quiet man, but he really could get talking if you were alone with two people or something. And he put my uncle at ease when he was very young about traveling the world, you know, because he was going out there alone with no money.
Yeah.
And Odo basically inspired him, you know, told him you can survive, you know, with a nickel. And, And he was right. Michael really did go out there, and I think that Odo had a lot to do with pushing him out the door and getting him to do these things.
Good answer. Yeah. You answered it. We just had a couple more. Glenn Speer.
Glenn Speer is the same age as my uncle was, and he basically met my uncle when he was moving into the castle, or onto the property in 1959. And he was just a kid, and he helped my uncle move furniture, and he looked around at all the tin buildings here, and Glenn asked if there was a place he could live, and my uncle thought about it for a minute and said, well, you could live in that place up there for $15 a month. And so Glenn became Michael's first renter. And Glenn was an artist. He was quite incredible. He was too young at the time for anybody to know it, but over the years here, he started doing sculptures, and he started doing stonework, you know, along with Michael, but he was so neat at it, Michael had to make him stop. You know, Michael liked to just, he said, I only have one lifetime to build a castle. You can't be careful. You know, and so Glenn eventually moved to the Virgin Islands and built a really famous place over there called Mongoose Junction, which is a big stone mall. It's a shopping center. And that was
Glenn Speer.
Yeah.
The guy that built that list. Wow.
That got started here, basically, because Glenn became a stone builder here and an artist. And he went there and made his life and did very well.
Wow. Okay. We've got one person left on this list. Sally Rand.
Uh-huh. Well, Sally, as I was growing up, I just knew her as my grandmother's best friend. I hardly ever, during the daytime, hardly ever saw my grandmother without Sally around.
I'm going to interrupt you. There are some people listening that may not know who Sally Rand is.
Oh,
so,
yeah,
in addition, so right. So as you explain this as your grandmother's best friend, you also have to remind us who Sally Rand was.
Okay. Sally Rand was a pretty big silent film star in the 20s. And when the talking movies came in, she didn't have a very good voice, and she kind of got phased out of the movies. But she thought of something new, which was to take off her clothes. And she became famous at the Chicago World's Fair in 1933. I think she was more famous there than she ever was as a movie star. And she developed the fan dance, which was done with these 7-foot ostrich feathers, ostrich fans. And she did that at the Chicago World's Fair. And she also had a little venue going on there called the Sally Rand Nude Ranch, which was a bunch of girls running around in bodysuits to look like they were naked, wearing gun belts and cowboy boots. And she worked all her life. Even into her 70s, she was still a popular star. And the last movie she appeared in was the movie The Right Stuff, about the astronauts. There's a scene where Sally Rand does a dance in that.
Yes.
And that was really her in that movie. But she was my grandmother's best friend. She was here at every party. And my uncle always had a little bit of a problem with her because she swore a lot. And my uncle didn't like swearing. It made him uncomfortable. She was like a sailor. And she smoked, and my uncle didn't like smoking. And even he smoked a pipe, but she smoked cigarettes. But she was a pretty big influence around here, too. We still have some of her furniture in the Tin Palace, and she actually used to store a lot more here. But she was a Glendora resident for a long time. And she even did a little fan dance at my 10th birthday party here in the Tin Palace.
We're going to stop.
Okay,
you've done it. You have given us the backstory for one of the most important folk art environments in California. Before we go, so we get people to stay tuned for the next episode of this interview, where you actually go through and talk about them blasting the holes in the water cistern, and once they blast at the bottom hole, they're like, okay, we can actually build in here. I want you, before we sign off and before we move on to the next interview for the next episode about the construction, tell us a story that will capture people's attention and keep us captivated to hear how this beautiful, beautiful medieval castle came up in a citrus grove in Glendora.
How do I? I've never done it like this before. Just a minute. Yeah. My uncle Michael started building that little bottle house in 1968, and it's hard to tell how much thought he had of actually building the castle then, but I think it, as he mixed the concrete and he was getting away with stuff, he got the roof on that thing, and he had really been bothered very little. The city knew what he was doing, but they didn't. They sent one guy up here once, and that guy went away, and Michael got away with it. And he started digging the foundations for the castle, and he didn't have a picture or a drawing. He didn't really tell people what he was doing, but people would come here after 1968, and every single day he would get home from his bus driving. He drove a school bus. He'd come home, and he'd mix concrete. And it never stopped until 1986.
Perfect. Scott, I want to thank you for talking to us, and we'll be back for part two.
Wonderful. I look forward to it.
My name is Suzanne Lummis, and I'm here in the Athletic Club on 7th Street in downtown L.A., and you're listening to You Can't Eat the Sunshine.
Mitchell, I'm here with you. We're at Rhodey's in San Dimas, which is one of my favorite diners. Will you please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your qualifications for the topic we're going to discuss today?
Okay. Well, you haven't given me the topic, so I'm not sure I'm qualified. But my name is Mitchell Crawford, and I'm the grandson of the founders, my grandparents, of the Crawfords' retailing empire, which consisted of grocery stores primarily in the San Gabriel Valley.
Good. Okay. Crawford's Corner at Valley and New is one of the really important landmarks in my life, and which is when I was introduced to you. I was like, oh, I can't wait to talk to you about this. So we're gonna get very quickly to that. I want to start with your grandparents with their origin story, which has to do with watermelons. So why don't you start with the watermelons and quickly get us to this growing retail empire, which is really a big part of San Gabriel Valley's growth post-war. I mean, this is part of the warp and weft of anyone listening who grew up in San Gabriel, and this is core. So take it away.
Okay. Well, my grandparents had done quite a few different jobs. For instance, my grandfather was a mechanic, worked on cars. He also sold cars, and to make a little extra money, I don't remember what the opportunity was, but they wound up selling a truckload of watermelons out of the back of a pickup truck, and they sold out. So that gave them the idea that perhaps there was money in food, and today that is still true because recessions come and go, and a lot of industries are affected over time, but people still have to eat. Now, what they do cut out a lot of times is discretionary food spending, which means that they won't go to a restaurant much, but they still will go to a grocery store. So they took that idea and over time built up a small chain of regional grocery stores here in Southern California. They had stores in Alhambra, El Monte, San Gabriel, Monterey Park, Pasadena, Glendale, Montebello, Anaheim, and even in Hollywood in Los Angeles at one time.
Wow, that's really good. That's really good. Why don't we let's start sort of in the middle. There is a split. Crawford's Corner and Crawford's El Monte started being handled administratively differently. Do you want to start there?
Sure.
And then we'll start with what was on your grandmother's side, which is Crawford's Corner, and then we'll just sort of work our way around this.
Well, somewhere in the 40s, I believe, my grandfather had an extramarital affair, and somehow my grandmother found out about it, And at some point, she pulled out a gun and shot him. Now, she didn't kill him. She, as I said, winged him earlier. And so my grandmother was booked. I remember there's a picture that my wife has found in some of the archives as she's been going through stuff of my father and my grandmother at the Alhambra police station after my father had bailed her out. And the gun went into the evidence locker, but somehow the gun disappeared. Now, I'd mentioned this to you earlier, but what was kind of interesting is about 15 years ago, one of my family members, I think it was would have been my grandmother's niece, gave my brother the gun. So it disappeared, but apparently it was in a family custody for all that time. Unfortunately, my brother's house got broken into, and that was one of the things that was stolen, because I told him, I think we ought to put that up in a frame and have it on the wall.
Okay, so
went and came.
So your grandmother subsequently filed for divorce, and they separated their business interests. And so this is why we're now going to work through the list of your grandmother's interests, and then your grandfather's. And to start with your grandmother's interests, I know that Glendale was the really big one, but because Crawford's Corner I love so dearly, will you please start with Crawford's Corner? And you have to tell us about the inspiration for this frontier-themed market.
Well, the market at Crawford's Corner, Valley and New, was actually the second store to be on that location that was a Crawford's. I'm old enough to actually have gone through the one that was originally there, and what I remember about it was during the winter time when it would rain, they'd have buckets set out all through the store because the roof was leaking. So they bought some additional property, and they wanted to do something that was going to be a little different, a little bit more upscale. And they designed it with kind of a Western theme, and we had a wonderful gentleman by the name of Les Armstrong who was in charge of construction and store design. Now, I don't know if he had the original idea to do a Western theme, because my uncle was very, very creative as well. But it was his job to carry that theme out. And so they built this wonderful store. Now, they had to build it while the other store was still on the property. And with the original store, they had the store, and then behind the store were the general offices, two separate buildings. When they built the new store, they built the offices as part of the complex, and they were above many of the rental locations that we had. That once they built the store and it was bigger and we had all these rental locations, we were not only a retailer, but we were also a landlord renting out to several people, including Save-On. We had a, see if I can remember this, we had a dry cleaner, we had a barber shop, we had a shoe repair that was there, we had a hairstyling salon, we had a Hallmark store, we had a restaurant, an Italian restaurant, and a ladies' fashion store, and there were a couple other stores which I can't remember. But so they built that store, and it was the store of the year for the it's not Supermarket News. It was like Southern California Supermarket News. They named that store the store of the year because it was so different at the time. It became kind of a destination place because it was more than just a grocery store. It was a place inside. We had, because of my uncle, we always had a snack bar in all of our stores. So you could go in and get a charbroiled burger, cheeseburger that was just out of this world. And if you wanted to, you could sit outside and eat it. We had a little grandstand gazebo that you could sit at and enjoy the burger or the sandwich or whatever. So that was the Valley and New store. And
what year did it win super approximately?
I believe that was 1962 when that store opened. And down the street toward the west was that was Crawford's number 9. The Valley and New store was our number 9 store. And the down the street was a smaller store, number 8. And so we had a very large store that had everything that you'd want as far as food. We had you know, the center store, which is all the canned goods. Yes. We had bulk food. We had the produce department, deli, dairy, the meat department. And we also had a large non-food section where you could buy clothing. We actually had a real hardware store in the back. We also had a post office inside. We were a contract postal station, which brought a bunch of foot traffic in. So the only thing we didn't have that you would probably see in many stores today, not all, is a pharmacy. We didn't we never operated pharmacies, but as you see today, a lot of places are operating pharmacies, even Costco, because it brings foot traffic into the store. You bring foot traffic in, while they're there, they're probably going to pick something else up.
Good. Why don't we, Pasadena, Montebello, just to round out the list?
Okay. We had stores in other parts of the city, other parts of Southern California. We had one in Pasadena on Colorado Boulevard, which is now a Guitar Center. That was a relatively small store. We had a beautiful store in Glendale, which the Valley & News store had a Western theme. The Glendale store had a New Orleans theme. And that store still exists, as does the Valley & News store, but they look the folks that run it, and this is not a criticism, the folks that are running the stores now are a little less interested in some of the ambiance that Crawford's was interested in and a little more interested in having merchandise in places. So at the Glendale store, if you go in, I don't think you'll see the fountain that we used to have that took, it was about a 12-foot diameter fountain, maybe more, and people used to throw coins in it, and we collected the money and donated it to a little local charity. So you could always go in and hear the sound of water running, which caused a bunch of people immediately to ask, where are the restrooms here?
And this Glendale store is now Ralph's, and it's on now, Stoker?
It's at 1200 North... 1200 North... It's the corner... not Brand... You know, I've forgotten the street. Brandon Stoker, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's still there. I believe it's a Ralph's. I have not been by there in a while. We had a store in Montebello, and the fun store, there are two fun stories about that. The first is, for the grand opening of the store, we gave away a red Cadillac convertible. To do that, to make a big splash, we also had searchlights. There used to be a company, I don't believe it's there anymore, in Pasadena at the corner of the apex of Walnut, and I don't remember the other street, called Horty Van. And Horty Van used to sell flags, but you could also rent honest-to-goodness searchlights. I mean, the ones that with the generator that came with it, it was actually two different trailers that you had to trail. So we got a bunch of searchlights. And apparently that caused a little confusion for some pilots coming into LAX because they didn't understand why there was some huge... Now, I've heard that story, but I actually saw the LA Times article just recently that my wife has been going through where they were concerned that maybe something was going on they didn't know about as far as war or under attack or something like that. The other thing that I think is really amazing, because we were giving away that red Cadillac, the Pomona Freeway had not been built yet. We caused a SIG alert on the 10 freeway because of people trying to get there to be able to get to the prize drawing for the red Cadillac. So apparently they were very successful. We had some very, very creative people that worked for us that were not blood relatives, but they became family members because the organization was very close and very supportive of each other. But we had some very creative people that did some amazing stunts to get people to show up at the stores. We used to have the El Monte store, the world's largest shopping basket that was loaded with stuff.
Well, let's hold on to El Monte. Why don't we jump over to your grandfather's side of the business, and we're now gonna look at his holdings.
Okay.
The largest of which was the El Monte store at Five Points, and I want you to set up for people what this store looked like, because this is a really important intersection for El Monte.
Okay, well, that was a very interesting location because there was a lot of stuff going on there. We used to have a gas station, a Douglas oil gas station. We used to have we're not even in the store yet, in the parking lot, we had a key maker, a locksmith. There was a car wash on the site. There was even a little amusement park, and that amusement park was run by, let's see if you guys know this, Bud, if you've heard the name, Bud Hurlbutt. Okay, Bud Hurlbutt was the guy who he got his start with a little amusement park there, and eventually managed all the rides at Knott's Berry Farm, and then he sold the business after Knott's went to an unlimited ride. He used to get every time somebody was on one of his attractions, he'd get a cut of the money. After it went unlimited, he didn't think it was such a good deal, so he sold, and he built the amusement park out off of Castle Amusement Park off the 91 freeway out in Riverside. And later on, I contacted him because we were doing something with the city of San Dimas and the LA County Fair, and I needed some advice on music and something, and he was just very excited to see me. Apparently, thank goodness, my family was very nice and kind to him, and he said, you know, because of your family, this is how I got my start. And he became a very wealthy man, but still a very modest man. So we had a little amusement park there.
We're not in the store yet.
We're not in the store yet. We had a little amusement park, a car wash in the back. We even had an area where we leased out for RV sales. Now, the store had two entrances, the front and the back. If you went in the front, on the left was a Red Goose shoe store that was sublet out. There was a shoe shine stand. You go in the store. We had in one section a camera, sporting goods, and toy section. On just to the left of that, as you're walking down the main aisle, on the left side would have been a Brookdale ice cream store, and then because it was Crawford's, we had our own snack bar there.
Right.
Across from the snack bar on the right was Harvey's Jewelers. It was a spot that we sublet. And then on the right side was the grocery side. So we had a regular grocery store that you would expect with perishables, meat, produce. We didn't do seafood in that store. On the left side, and they each had their own set of check stands, was our non-food side. So you could buy hardware, you could buy clothing, you could buy knickknacks. And we also in that store had a post office, again, to bring people in. We offered a check cashing service for people to be able to come in and cash their checks, which at the time was a big deal because you had to go to your bank, and the banks had limited hours and usually long lines. And of course, back then there were no ATMs. If just past the on the right side again, past the grocery side, was a Topper's Rotisserie Barbecue, which I'm still searching for their recipe because it was out of this world rotisserie chicken. Now, I'm afraid when I'm going to find it, I'm going to find out that 90% of the recipe was salt. But I can tell you, everybody really enjoyed that. And then we had an area just past that on the right side that was two different things at one time. We decided to put in a full-service liquor department, and with cold beer, so that was near the other entrance.
Right.
And people could run in very easily, park, run in, grab a beer or two or six-pack or something cold. We also, and I don't remember which was first, we also had for a while sold appliances there. Now, if you continued out toward the exit, if you could go out the exit to the parking lot, on that would be on the south side. Or if you made a hard left turn, you went to the Patio Cafe. And we had a cafe that was cafeteria style. But because my father was always looking for ways to make money, my grandfather was an inventor, and so he was always looking for things that you could do. He could have been a time and motion engineer. Things that you could do to reduce the cost and be able to pass the savings on to the customer or do something more efficient. Contrary, my father was always thinking, I wonder how we can make some money. So he had he opened up a pool sales company, Swan Pools, and he had, in the patio cafe, had a pool installed back there. And so it was very unusual because you could eat around the pool. And so it was a nice, gentle, and with the water in the pool, you know, it moderated the temperature, so it was never too cold back there, never too hot. So the El Monte store to this day, now I'm 62, 2, if I do my math right. Anybody that's, I'm going to say, 70 or older that lives in the San Gabriel Valley, when they find out that I'm associated with the Crawford's Markets and that my family was involved, they say, oh my gosh, that El Monte store. I remember going there. We used to spend all day there. Now, I doubt very much that they spent all day there, but, you know, they were able to do their shopping. They could have a little amusement with the amusement park there if they wanted to. They could get their car cleaned. They could eat there, and, of course, they could do their shopping as well. So,
how about a pet shop?
I don't believe we had a pet shop there, but it's possible, because what did happen is things would change. We actually had 3 restaurants there at the time. If you go in the entrance that I took you in initially, to the left, well, to the right, there were several shops, including a barber shop, which is still there to this day, and it says it's called Crawford's Barber Shop. To the left, though, there was an area that they used for multiple things, and they created kind of a Western-themed restaurant. And so we had many of the ladies that were attractive cashiers became waitresses there, and they kind of enjoyed that because they got paid the same, but they got tipped. They didn't get tipped at the cash register. And I remember seeing, as a young boy, probably somewhere around 8 or 9, seeing some of my favorite cashiers dressed up in, I wouldn't say they were skimpy outfits, but they were more abbreviated than what they would wear running a cash register. And I'm thinking, wow, this is kind of cool. I may switch from the patio cafe to be over here a little bit more often.
We cannot forget your grandfather and the check stand design, the P&L machine. Mm-hmm. So tell us about the P&L.
As I said earlier, my grandfather was always looking for a better way to do things. And he used to take apart stuff at home. He kept bees. And so he was looking for a way to extract the honey out of the honeycomb, the slabs that you'd pull out. And so my grandmother came home one time and he had disassembled the washing machine to be able to get to the motor, to be able to create a centrifuge to spin that out. Well, standing around watching, studying what was going on in the store, he realized that with the conveyor belt system, there was a 2 conveyor belt system. One would bring the merchandise that was to be rung up, the customer is unloaded, up to the cashier. They were supposed to pick it up and ring it up and then put it down on the second one, which would take it to the box boy. But a lot of times they didn't pick everything up, and the merchandise would push, and it would actually push the merchandise from the one belt to the other belt, and as a result, the cashiers didn't always ring everything up. So my grandfather thought, how can we improve this? And what he did is he created a P&L bar, and it essentially was a bar that was attached to a micro switch, and when the product came up on the conveyor belt and hit that micro switch, it would flex a little bit, or pivot actually, and it would stop the conveyor belt from running. What this required was for the cashier to actually pick it up, ring it up, and then put it down on the other belt that it would convey it to the box boy. And so what happened is sales went up and profits went up, because now everything was being rung up that the customer was buying. So the customers may not have been happy about that, because they may have been getting a little bit of a discount each time they came in. But that's now the standard in the industry. Today, instead of a mechanical device, they use an electric eye. If you go into just about any store these days, it stops it just at the cashier. And typically now also you have between where the cashier is and where the area is for the box boy, typically you also have a scale that's there. Yeah. And they didn't have what we would call inline scales back at that time. The other thing that my grandfather did with the check stand that you still see it some places, but it's very rare, is he put in an elevated Lazy Susan rack. And what they would do, what the cashier would do, is that they had bread or anything that could get damaged or crushed or squished, like tomatoes or something, or peaches, something that was delicate, that would go on that top of that rack. So the cans that were coming down, the heavy items, were not going to, the bags of sugar, were not going to flatten your bread. And that was very easy for the box boys, because we didn't have box girls back then. The box boys would fill a bag, and they were always instructed to put delicate things on the top. They'd pick it off the Lazy Susan, put it in, put it in the cart, bang, continue on. So my grandfather on that side, well, both my grandparents were very smart, but he was always looking, how can we do this better?
I want you, because we got to bring this on home. You've told us so many wonderful, inspiring stories. I want you to tell us one thing that you haven't mentioned. I know you have a million things in your head, but just pick one truly great thing you want to share with us about this vast empire that you were privileged enough to grow up in and be part of.
Well, I'm kind of stumbling because there's a bunch of things that are going through my head, but for me personally, I had a chance to work in El Monte, Alhambra, Glendale, Montebello, Anaheim, and Crawford's was always a part of the community. And so I had a chance to learn a lot about, in working in the stores, learn a lot about the various communities. Here in San Dimas, one of the city council members is a former assistant police chief for the city of Alhambra. And I told him, and he wasn't there in Alhambra at the time, but he said, oh, I didn't know you were related to those Crawfords. We had unfortunately, we had a Alhambra police officer that was killed. And we were building the new Valley and News store. And so there's nothing inside the store. We've got the roof on, but it's just empty inside. My family had the idea, let's do a fundraiser. And so we opened the store up and served food and collected money from people as a donation to help the slain officer's family. And I guess that's one of the, I'm choking up thinking about it. My family always wanted to help the community. We weren't there just to take money. We were there to sell them groceries and to make a profit, because that's how you pay employees, you get people raises, you remodel stores. But we weren't just there for that. We were always there to help the community. And so I think that's one of the things that I'll always remember as a young kid. That would have been, I think, 1961, because I think we opened that store, as I said earlier, in 62. So that's one of the things that I'll always treasure.
Mitchell, you did it. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and I'm ready for volume 2, 3, and 4, because I've got plenty of stories.
My name is Paul Sand, and I'm here in Santa Monica, and you're listening to You Can't Eat the Sunshine.
And we're done. I'd like to thank everyone for listening to our latest podcast of You Can't Eat the Sunshine for the week of November 3rd, 2014. Our guests this week were Mitchell Crawford and Scott Rubel, and we want to hear from you. We like feedback. So, Kim, let's get into the feedback loop. And even as I say this, I realize that our iTunes link is broken. I know. And I'm waiting to hear back from Apple. I don't know what to do. So people should subscribe. I'm going to fix it, okay? I know. I'm going to fix it.
I'm so sorry. You know, it's not iTunes' fault, and it's not our fault. It has something to do with FeedBurner. But the important thing to remember is, if you actually like this show, you're probably going through withdrawal symptoms at the beginning of every week, and you should just go to our website and go, hey, is there a new episode? And you can download it manually. You can listen. I know, I'm sorry, it's ridiculous. You can listen to it in your browser. We'll get it fixed. You'll be able to subscribe again. And, of course, you can always get in touch with us, and we love it when you do. You can eat the sunshine at gmail.com or through the contact link at www.esoteric.com. You can join us on an esoteric bus adventure, or you can come to one of the lava events, free or paid. We'll have some more lava events on the calendar soon, so keep an eye peeled for that. And, of course, just generally know that it's a pleasure to hear from our podcast listeners, but you know that already. Richard, you're...
Okay, Kim, good. That was good?
No, I have to say something.
I know. You need to bring us on home.
No, I'm not going to bring us on home yet. I'm going to say, Richard, I know you feel it's somehow your fault. You somehow angered FeedBurner.
No.
And you didn't.
No, I don't know what... I have feeds in my FeedBurner account that are 7 years old that haven't had content pushed through them in 6. And all of a sudden, you emailed me on Monday and said, last Monday, and said, hey, why do we have no stats? And I just said, what? And I logged into the account, and the feed that takes our raw feed from our website of our podcast filters it through FeedBurner and pumps it into iTunes with grammatically correct and closure tabs, so iTunes is very happy. This feed was gone.
Right, and the reason that I'm goading you to say all that is that hopefully someone listening to this podcast understands what happened and can help us.
No, it was deleted. Somehow FeedBurner deactivated our feed, and I don't know why they did that.
Right, and I don't...
And the first CEO of FeedBurner I invited to our wedding. So, you know, like, really.
Did he come?
No, he didn't, but he thought about it, and he's long gone. Google bought them, but, you know, FeedBurner... I have a long history with FeedBurner, so I'm really crushed and confused.
So hopefully someone listening to this understands what happened and can help us. Let's move on to more interesting matters. We have some upcoming events, none of which involve dealing with our FeedBurner feed. We have the Weird West Adams Crime Bus Tour on November the 8th. It's a real collaboration between Richard and myself. I talk about all of the grisly weird crimes, although Richard had some crimes on that tour as well. And then Richard shares with us the story of how this neighborhood just to the west of downtown L.A. was integral in the destruction of restrictive housing covenants, not just in Southern California, but nationwide, so that people could live wherever they wanted to live. And it's pretty interesting stuff and probably something you didn't think about as you were flying through what was West Adams on the 10 freeway at some point in your recent or distant past. We have on November the 22nd, Hotel Horrors and Main Street Vice. It's a crime and double feature tour of downtown Los Angeles featuring all my favorite people. Mummies, B-girls, serial killers, and some of the most beautiful turn of the last century hotel interiors you could possibly imagine. And I'm very much looking forward to going into the King Edward Hotel and seeing some of that great black and gold marble that we've been spotting out and about.
Hold on, I have something to say. Everything's fine.
What is it?
It's been a long time, and I can now talk about it. When you wrote Hotel Horrors and Main Street Vice, you conceived of it, and we executed it for the first time as two standalone tours with separate admission with an hour meal break in between at the American Cafe in the Arts District. And personally, that was like one of the worst experiences of my entire life, and I'm so glad that after it was over, you agreed with me without even having to fight, without even a discussion. You just across the board said, yes, Richard, we're never going to do that again. But I just, it was such a good idea in the abstract, and in execution, it was such a nightmare.
There's a reason that when theaters do double features, they just put you in your seats and you stay there, and all you can do is get up and go to the bathroom or get popcorn. Anything else is really a bridge too far. And groups of 50 people, when they're fending for themselves, they'll do the strangest things. You're quite right, Richard. Quite right. In any case, so Hotel Horrors Main Street Vice is now a combined tour. You get on the bus, you stay on the bus, you'll learn a lot about downtown L.A.
And it is one of all my tours are favorite, but it's really a great tour.
Thank you.
It's our mailman.
Yeah. You got any mail?
No.
You want to go check the mail?
No.
All right. The 29th of November. It's a very intimate podcast. It's Richard's once-a-year birthday bus adventure. And when I say once a year, it's really once in a lifetime, because every year we pick somewhere different to go to explore in Southern California for Richard's birthday bus, which is a combination architectural and history tour and a birthday party. And this year, Nathan Marsak is our host. Ghost host with the most, and he'll be taking us through some of his and our favorite mausolea. That's the plural of mausoleum, which is where they put lots and lots of corpses in Southern California. Los Angeles and Orange County cemeteries are being visited. We'll be seeing some places that normally you cannot get inside without a key if you're not a family member or a board member. And, of course, we'll be having a fabulous Indian buffet feast as part of the day out. It's really going to be fun. It's November 29th. It's a little longer than our usual tours.
7 hours.
It's 7 hours. It's hellbent. You're going to see some great nooks and crannies of the OC along the way. And we've been out and scouting. So if you want to get some previews, you can check out our Instagram feed and you'll see a few photos. It's beautiful. beautiful places, and we'd love to see you there. On December the 6th, it's Pasadena Confidential with Crimebo the Clown. And, of course, our Pasadena Confidential tour is becoming quite topical. What with last month you had Cameron, the artist, on the cover of the LA Weekly, one of our featured characters since the birth of this tour, and also Jack Parsons, Cameron's husband, fascinating rocket scientist, occultist, and victim of a mysterious death, is now going to be subject to an AMC miniseries. So all this stuff is definitely in the air. It's a tour about rocket science, black magic, insane millionaires, very, very bad behavior generally.
Pets.
Yes, millionaires with weird pets. Very fun tour. And of course, Crimebo the Clown will be joining us. So if you need your Christmas photo taken, or your Hanukkah photo, or Kwanzaa, or what have you, with a crime clown, December 6th should give you plenty of time to get some nice prints made down at wherever you get your prints made, probably in your home office. Eastside Babylon is on December the 13th. It is, without a doubt, my most unhinged crime bus tour. We'll go to Evergreen Cemetery and talk about the carnies. We'll go to Hubbard Street and talk about the really extraordinary community takedown of the Night Stalker. We'll talk about the Radio Shop murders. We'll drink... Oh, I think it's the right time of year. We'll have some eggnog.
Yes, there will be eggnog.
At Brugere's Dairy, which is our snack break.
That's why we... That's,
I that, did, you, yeah, you did yeah. that on purpose. Thanks. Honestly...
Because last time we did it, they didn't have it.
They didn't have the eggnog because it was a little early.
We were a week too early, so I
People
switched.
Like the eggnog. Personally, I really like the chocolate milk, so I'm going to get some chocolate milk for the group too, but we'll have some eggnog as well. That's Eastside Babylon. And that's our last tour of the year. But I do want to give you a preview of what's coming up next, because this tour does always sell out, and it's a very profound experience to, during the first week or so of January, take the Real Black Dahlia tour, because it's around the time of Bess Short's kidnapping and murder.
I think it's the day after. The 10th.
Well, we're going out on the 10th, and yeah, she was probably in the custody of whoever ended up killing her by that point. She certainly disappeared. There are no known sightings of her after the evening of the 9th, and then her body shows up less than a week later in Leimert Park. It is our most popular crime bus tour, and we'd love to see you aboard, and it is already filling up, so that would be January 10th, the Real Black Dahlia.
And just you know, because I know the schedule better than you do, because I put the calendar events on, January, Raymond Chandler, the 17th, Charles Bukowski, 24th, and Jamie Kane, Birth of Noir, January 31. So we've got we're coming out like a lion in January. So I want to thank everyone for listening. I want to encourage you to continue to listen, and I want to I really want to remind you.
You can't eat the sunshine.
You can't eat the sunshine, but you can make a beeline for the best of the coastline. La 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 la. Skid Row, Solano Canyon, the Doria, and Pico Union, the long lost neighborhood called Herman between South Pass and Highland Park, Grand Central Park. It is divine. You can't eat the sunshine, but it's a gold mine.